It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll check out some long, mostly forgotten Wisconsin history, how Wisconsin lost the Upper Peninsula to Michigan.
First, President Obama wrapped up his trip to Alaska today. He's the first sitting president to visit the Alaskan Arctic. The purpose of his trip was to highlight the effects of climate change. He also visited some of the most beautiful spots in the nation, outside of Wisconsin, while he was there.
Sarah Wheaton is with us to talk about the president's trip. She is a White House reporter for Politico. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah, how significant was the president's trip to Alaska?
Well, it was symbolic in some ways. As you noted, he will be the first sitting president to go north of the Arctic Circle. In fact, I just got a poor report that his plane just landed in the past 10 or 20 minutes or so there. And it's actually been sort of a surprisingly controversial trip. He's managed to alienate Ohioans by changing the name of a mountain in Alaska. And it has also showed some of the tensions between the president and the environmental movement. He's going to highlight the effects of climate change on Alaska, but at the same time, he's actually visiting some areas near where he has just approved to let Shell do some oil drilling. And so there are a lot of different debates going on, even as the president goes on this very scenic and photo op heavy trip.
Right, so you mentioned all these flashpoints that are maybe taking away or giving a more complex picture of than the original intended purpose, which was to talk about climate change. So has that main purpose, talking about climate change, still been served, or has it been overshadowed?
It's hard to tell. I think it's probably still been served, and the White House has also been working to use its social media prowess. The president took over the White House Instagram account, used a selfie stick, and he has been giving some very powerful messages on his first day there. He spoke at a conference in Anchorage that also featured other Arctic nations, and he gave sort of a fire and brimstone and ice speech about what is happening in Alaska. He talked about how villages in Alaska are basically, the ice underneath them is melting and they're falling into the sea. He talked about how the permafrost is burning. And I think those messages may have really gotten through. And, of course, the pictures of all the beautiful places that he's visiting, that he's been saying need to be preserved for our grandchildren, those are all potentially going viral on Twitter and Instagram.
Well, let's talk about some of the critics of the president's message there. Some critics calling this trip hypocritical because a few weeks ago the president approved Shell's request to drill in the Arctic Circle. Give us a little bit more of the story there.
Right. So even though the president has really tried to make climate change a key part of his legacy, some of the most hardcore environmentalists are very frustrated with him. And one of those things is because he did approve, and is the first president to approve this type of drilling in the Arctic, oil drilling in the Arctic Circle. And one climate activist in Slate compared it to his mission accomplished moment, basically going to Alaska to say that he's taken all this strong action on climate change and at the same time is allowing this type of drilling. But what the White House says is that, look, the president supports an all-of-the-above approach to energy. And while the White House has really encouraged a lot of development of alternative energies like solar and wind power, and he did also announce some new initiatives to do that in Alaska, at the same time, they note that hasn't happened all at once. And so the United States does still need to provide its own oil, and allowing Shell to drill here is one way of doing that.
And has the president himself said anything on this trip? I understand there have been some protesters. You said the White House had commented. What about the president?
Yes, some protesters held up signs outside, saying some words that I probably shouldn't put on the radio. But I do not believe that the president has directly addressed this. He's actually just kind of given, aside from his comments in Anchorage about the effects of climate change in Alaska, he's mostly focused on making some announcements about some new icebreakers and announcing new plans to help Native Alaskans deal with the effects of climate change.
We're talking with Sarah Wheaton right now, White House reporter for Politico. She's talking about the president's trip to Alaska, which is wrapping up today. Now, you mentioned those icebreakers. That has been an interesting sidebar to this trip, the president announcing that the United States needs money for more icebreakers and highlighting this not just as a climate change issue, but as a national security issue.
Exactly. So as Sarah Palin most memorably made clear to the rest of the country, Russia is so close to Alaska that you can see it, Russia from some parts of Alaska. And as the Arctic ice has been melting, that has been creating new shipping channels at the very top of the planet. But they're still, you know, boats can't just kind of sail through or chug through as they are, and they do need the help of icebreakers. And right now, the U.S. only has about three, and it really only has one that can really push through these 15-foot sheets of ice. And that's used mainly for rescue purposes. It also needs to go down to Antarctica and in the southern hemisphere. And so President Obama is proposing to speed up the acquisition of a new icebreaker. But the big issue is that Russia has many icebreakers. I believe they have about 40 now, with maybe another dozen or so in the works. And that means that Russia is basically dominating this shipping in this new, very important area. There's also access to oil resources and natural gas resources there. And if the Russians are the ones who can break through that ice, then they'll also have the most access to those resources. At the same time, there's also been military buildup by Russia, and so the Alaskans are feeling very anxious about this issue. The governor, Bill Walker, who is an independent but used to be a Republican, he has been very supportive of the administration's efforts to bring in new icebreakers and to generally shore up the census in Alaska.
And lastly, you mentioned renaming Mount McKinley to Mount Denali, and that has been controversial in Ohio. But what about Alaska? How's it going over there?
In Alaska, it's very popular, and it's had bipartisan support. So at least where President Obama is currently at the moment, he's not facing much pushback on that. And since he's not running for re-election, it doesn't matter quite as much to him what people think in Ohio right now.
So as the president wrapped up this visit today, are people saying this has been a successful trip, or has it been too dogged by some of these other issues?
I think it will depend. So we'll have to see what Republican resistance is to some of these measures. Before this trip, he released some very broad new climate regulations and carbon limits, and those are really seen as the most important part of his environmental legacy. And so if Republicans continue taking actions to really block that, that could be a sign that this trip maybe wasn't as successful as they might have hoped. Also, there'll be some big climate negotiations in Paris at the end of the year. And so I think the president is really trying to get support for that. And I should be clear, he's not really reaching out to Republicans specifically in this trip, but to the general American public. He's trying to make people realize that that climate change is an issue that affects them, even if they're not feeling it right now. He made a very strong case in Anchorage that we no longer need to have the discussion, the debate of economy versus environment. I don't know if everybody necessarily agrees with the president about that, but he's making the case that the economy can still be strong while fighting climate change. And so he's trying to gain support from the American public, who can keep the pressure on opponents of climate change legislation in Congress.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Wheaton, White House reporter for Politico. She was with us to talk about President Obama's trip to Alaska, which just wrapped up today.
Wisconsin has no shortage of fabulous vacation spots, but chances are if you've gone exploring in northeastern Wisconsin, you've maybe ventured over into what's known as the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. If you check out a map, it's pretty clear this chunk of land along Lake Superior is attached to northern Wisconsin, yet it belongs to Michigan, and it has for over 100 years.
Our next guest is here to tell us why Wisconsin doesn't own the UP. James Johannet is a writer and blogger. He wrote about the history of Michigan's Upper Peninsula for Volume 1 in Eau Claire. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So to investigate the fate of the Upper Peninsula, we have to start with Ohio and the Michigan Territory. Why do we start there?
Yeah, so it's weird that why Wisconsin doesn't have claim over the Upper Peninsula. It would start with Ohio, but it starts with a little bit of a turf war between Ohio and Michigan, centered around a little tract of land that includes the city of Toledo. Toledo is on Lake Erie, which collected up most of the trade for Ohio, which was a state at the time, whereas Michigan was only still a territory. And within a couple of years, Michigan decided that it was going to petition for statehood. But that's where things got a little bit more complicated.
Right. There was an argument over how this boundary line was drawn, and it led to a war between Michigan and Ohio?
Yeah. I mean, someone got stabbed, so I'll consider it a war. The way mapping worked back then was a little bit more difficult. They didn't exactly have satellite imaging, so they just sort of had to give it their best shot. And the map that most cartographers and political boundary drawers used was something called the John Mitchell map, which was made in 1787. But the map wasn't exactly correct. And when people were starting to make boundary lines between places like Michigan and Ohio and other places as they were creating state lines, they would generally create it as sort of an idea, which in this case was an east-west line drawn through the southern bend of or extreme of Lake Michigan. And the problem with that is that that interpretation of the line, when compared with the map they were using, created a space that no one owned.
Right, and so tell us about the stabbing that happened, because this did become sort of a no man's land.
Yeah, within a couple of years after Michigan petitioned for statehood, Ohio, they used the interpretation of the actual map that someone had corrected ever since the John Mitchell map came out, and they used the initial interpretation of Ohio's limit between Ohio and Michigan, which, of course, made something called the Toledo Strip, which was this no man's land. But what happened after that was both sides started sending in militia between Ohio and Michigan into this 5 to 8 mile wide strip. And there was a man named Sir Benjamin Stickney, and his two sons, one Stickney and two Stickney.
And those are their real names, right?
Those are his real names. I've looked this up in a couple of sources out of actual Toledo, and he did name his sons one and two. So I don't know if Dr. Seuss sort of thought about that when that came around, but I think that may have been some of the inspiration. But he took him and his sons into the Toledo Strip to try and vote in an election in the Toledo Strip in the side of Ohio. He was tried to be detained by a Michigan sheriff, and there was a stabbing. There was not a fatality, but there was still a stabbing.
Talking to James Jehanet from Volume 1 and volume1.org. He is telling us how Michigan ended up with the Upper Peninsula, even though it's attached to Wisconsin. So, obviously, after the stabbing, there wasn't a huge shooting war. Tempers cooled. What happened to resolve that led the Upper Peninsula to get involved?
Well, everything sort of toned down from there pretty quickly. All the militias were pulled back out, and the federal government realized that this was going to get way out of hand really quickly unless they put a stop to it. So they got to make an arrangement between Michigan and Ohio where Michigan would give up that strip of land and it would go to Ohio. But then they would get what we, of course, call the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. At that time, it was still part of Wisconsin territory. But at that point, basically everything east of Michigan was Wisconsin territory, and they were just sort of starting to cordon off sections of it and give it to state after state as Wisconsin territory was starting to move towards statehood. But as things cooled down, they made the arrangement. Toledo was given over to Ohio. Michigan then took the Upper Peninsula, and it was only a couple more years until Wisconsin ratified its own statehood, of course, without the Upper Peninsula.
Did anyone from the Wisconsin Territory at the time ever say, hold on there, that land is pretty much attached to where we are. Maybe we should lay a claim to it.
Well, it didn't happen right away. everyone thought the Upper Peninsula was kind of not all that worth, not worth all that much right away. They couldn't really tell what was, you know, what was the reason for anyone to fight over that at all. So Wisconsin really didn't give much of a fight for it. But after a while, they started to realize that there was so much iron and nickel ore and copper ore in the Upper Peninsula that it actually created more wealth than the gold rush did in California over a couple of years, anyway.
I'm from Michigan originally, and I think the feeling was trading Toledo for the Upper Peninsula, no offense to Toledo, was a pretty good deal. Is there a sense in Wisconsin history, looking back, that, hey, what? Why didn't we get that? They didn't even have a bridge then.
It's a strange situation, because when you look at it, Wisconsin and Michigan have sort of different, you know, slightly different cultures, not like that extremely different of cultures. But the UP has almost created its own sort of niche in terms of creating its own culture, distinctly different from both Wisconsin and Michigan. So, well, mainland Michigan anyway. So I'm not sure that it really belongs with anyone.
And Rob, you said, Rob and I were talking about this before, and you told me, Rob, that there was a secessionist movement in the UP.
For a while, they wanted to start a state called Superior, and this went on and off for a number of years, James. Did you encounter that in researching? This is well after the time period you covered.
Yeah, I did run into that. They tried to, and there's still been, you know, people trying to separate off the UP and create the state of Superior, and there's actually been 20 to 30 different movements like that around the country. The Upper Peninsula is far from the only separatist state movement in the country.
Interesting. Well, here's one thing we can agree on. I think that the shape of Wisconsin is more pleasing without the UP. Yes?
I agree.
Okay.
I mean, I think it would be sort of more blobby with the UP.
All right. So for the mapping aesthetic sense, it makes sense. James, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
That's James Jahanet. He's a writer and blogger. You can read his piece about the history of Michigan's Upper Peninsula at volume1.org. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll talk to a reporter about today's public hearings on a pair of bills that would alter funding for Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin.
First, a look at a growing obsession with food. Not just cooking it and eating it, but watching other people cook it, sharing pictures of it online, and more.
And there's been growing interest in what's in our food as people go gluten-free or vegan to avoid foods that use GMOs.
Either way, our guest says Americans, and especially younger people, have developed, in effect, an obsession with food.
We're joined now by Eve Turow to talk about this growing food obsession. Eve is the author of the book A Taste of Generation Yum, How a Generation's Love for Organic Fare, Celebrity Chefs, and Microbrews Will Make or Break the Future of Food. Eve, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Eve, when did you first start to pick up on this, what you call an obsession with food among young people, specifically the millennial generation?
It really was about 4 years ago when I moved to New York City, and here is like the, you know, highest infusion of food obsession. And looked up one day and just thought to myself, what the heck is going on here?
And what did you see people doing that struck you as different than how people had related to food over the last decade or so?
Right. Well, so what I began to realize is that young people today are using food in the way that our parents once used rock and roll or drugs. We're using food as a form of self-identification, as a way to express our values. So things that I think our parents don't, that we do that our parents think doesn't make any sense are things like, you know, using money for truffle cheese when we really should be paying rent, or paying for a high-end dinner out. Things like that that are kind of totally new to this generation. On top of that, we're taking pictures of what we eat and posting it online. There's a great question of why are we interested in looking at pictures of someone else's lunch?
Right, and you mentioned a woman that you spoke to who called her frozen yogurt store every day to see what the change in flavors was.
Exactly. So I was getting my MFA at the new school, sitting in class, and a peer of mine pulls out her phone and is explaining that the flavors change every day at this frozen yogurt shop. And she had programmed the number for the frozen yogurt shop into her phone. And it was really this moment of, wow, like this is more than a trend. This is something that people are really caring about, that they are involving in their everyday. And you're seeing it from things as simple as calling a frozen yogurt shop to giving up your life in an urban center to go out and become a craft brewer or a cheesemonger.
So I guess the question you're getting at here is why is this happening? I mean, it's a new phenomenon, but what is going on here that you see with this particular generation that is taking this food interest to another level?
Exactly. So the group of people that I'm looking at here is specifically the millennial generation, which graduated into the recession. We currently owe $1 trillion in student loan debt, and we're also the first generation to be raised with technology. So there are a lot of questions about why we would be spending our discretionary income on something that's as ephemeral as food. And there's lots of different trends that will tell you that food culture is proliferating, but no one's really looked at the why. What is it about food that is satisfying to us as a generation? And that's really where I tried to dig in a little bit deeper and get to the underlying motivations. And what I found is that it really comes down to food as the anti-technology. We are the first generation that's raised in the digital era. So we had one foot in and one foot out. I grew up learning the Dewey Decimal System, but at the same time also learning how to create a really great PowerPoint. And today we're lamenting, you know, what is the effect of being in front of a screen? And no one was looking at where young people today are truly different than all generations before. And it really boils down to our affinity of food. So food is offering us a few key things that are, to me, the anti-technology. Food is offering us the ability to gather with people in a community setting. We're putting down our phones when we're eating. Granted, we are taking the obligatory, beauty shot of whatever we're eating and then putting the phone down. But really using time with food to engage with other people. It's also allowing for sensory stimulation. A lot of us are spending times connected to our devices and not receiving the kind of stimulation that we're craving so much. During a lot of my research, I've heard people talking about a craving for the tangible, for something they could really feel and see and taste and smell. Food, as I mentioned before, is also providing a new way for young people to identify themselves. We're expressing our values by not just what we buy, but when we then take a picture of and post online. So if you're buying some organic kale, that's saying that you care about the environment, that you're an educated eater, and that you care about your own health. And then we're also using food as a means of control. One of the more interesting findings throughout the years of talking to millennials and luminaries in the food world is that a lot of young people today feel incredibly out of control. Growing up in the digital age has led us to an area where there are a whole new set of worries that young people have to deal with. A little bit of a confusion. You know, I don't really know how my iPhone works. I don't really know how the internet works. I don't really know if I've been hacked. And it's creating a sense of instability. Food allows you to break something down into its parts, whether that's breaking down a recipe or breaking down a whole cow.
We're talking right now to Eve Turow. She's the author of the book, A Taste of Generation Yum, How a Generation's Love for Organic Fare, Celebrity Chefs, and Microbrews Will Make or Break the Future of Food. And let's talk a little bit about the issue of control. That was kind of an interesting one to dig into. For one thing, you said the millennial generation doesn't feel that sense of control and that food is one thing that can be controlled. And you even spoke with a woman who had formerly been anorexic earlier in her life and got the same pleasure from really digging deep into her obsession with food and what she chose to eat now as she did when she was anorexic.
Exactly. And really, that interview really struck a chord with me and made me dig a little bit deeper to see if what she had experienced was true among other populations. And today we're seeing a proliferation of food restrictions. So paleo, vegan, flexitarian, locavore, gluten-free is huge. We're seeing it everywhere. But the question really is, you know, why? Why are people suddenly identifying themselves by their diet? Why are they so excited by restricting food? Or satisfied by restricting food? And while it can be difficult for some people to grapple with, there is a huge amount of evidence that really choosing what you eat and limiting what you eat does provide the same kind of emotional satisfaction as some other eating disorders. It's well known that if you're choosing not to eat, that a lot of the time that is associated with a need for control. This particular subject was expressing that same need for control as being satisfied by choosing just to eat local or just to eat organic. And in my research, I found that that was particularly true as well in the gluten-free community.
Now, when you talk about that aspect, it doesn't sound quite as healthy, but what about the overarching look at this, the bird's eye view? Is this a good thing that we're seeing, this obsession with food among millennials?
You know, I really do think that it is something that's healthy. Of course, you know, there is the flip side to this, but all in all, if people are educating themselves more about what they eat, I think it's a great thing. So even if it's done for superficial reasons or as a self-soothing reason, the matter of fact is that people are really investing a lot of time into learning about who's producing their food, how it's produced, what is the nutritional value of that. And I think that food is going to be one of the key issues that we as a generation face in terms of the environment, in terms of agriculture. So we are more and more educated about where our food comes from, how it's made, how it's distributed, and no matter how we're engaging, I think it's a great thing.
Well, and I guess that's the thing. Has it translated into an interest in the politics of food and the policies surrounding food, or is it right now almost a fetishization that is healthy and that it brings you together with other people? It's a sensory input that might be lacking, but has it translated to broader things beyond the individual person?
Right. Well, so that's one of the biggest questions that, to be honest, I'm still grappling with. So we are seeing the largest population ever of students that are entering food studies programs, which I think is fantastic. So if you look at the statistics of schools that are offering food studies options, it's grown so much over the last 10 years. So we have a lot of people that are thinking more about the policy side of things. But, you know, I posed this question. I ended up talking to Michael Pollan for my own book. And he's very revered in kind of the foodie world. And I asked him, you know, what do you think is really going to happen? And his true response was, no matter what, if you're thinking more about what you eat, that's going to translate and proliferate, right? So if you're concerned about eating gluten-free or only local, once these young millennials are having kids, it's more likely that they're not going to be giving their kids the same processed foods that we were given, and that hopefully this attention to what we're eating and how it's grown is going to continue along, and that all these fabulous students who are in food studies programs will kind of, you know, take that flag and march us forward to a better food future in the United States.
And is it just millennials, or did you find any evidence that this was being translated to older people, too?
I think that whatever millennials are doing is bound to affect other generations. So we're one quarter of the U.S. population, one third of the global population, and we have immense buying power. And I think that the way that millennials are spending their money and spending their time is starting to affect a number of things outside of just food. It's affecting, the workplace and transportation and food delivery systems, all of these different things. So I really do believe that it is centered in the millennial generation and now the younger centennials or Gen Z. They're really kind of picking up where we've left off and are even more in some ways food obsessed. And I think that our interest is just influencing our parents and the people that are kind of looking on, and it's influencing what businesses are offering.
We're talking right now with food writer Eve Turow about her new book, which focuses on how younger generations are shaping the world of food. Her new book is called A Taste of Generation Yum.
And we want to hear from you. Are you hearing your story? Are you, whether you're a millennial or not, thinking more about what you eat lately, being more selective? Do you watch people cooking on TV? Is it fun? What does that do for you? And why do you think the obsession with posting pictures or recipes online has developed in the past few years? Do you think this interest in food is here to stay or just a passing fad? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our discussion on the changing nature of food in just a few minutes. But first, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the growing obsession with food among the millennial generation. And we want you to join us. Have you developed a food passion or obsession like this recently? Do you find yourself being more picky these days about where your food comes from or maybe how it's made? And why do you think food has gained so much popularity recently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Eve Turow stays with us. Her new book is A Taste of Generation Yum, How a Generation's Love for Organic Fare, Celebrity Chefs, and Microbrews Will Make or Break the Future of Food.
We go to our callers now. We've got Jonah on the line in London. Hi there.
Hi, it's Jonah. But anyway, I was just saying that I'm in my 50s, And ever since I can remember, I've always gardened. I learned how to can, done everything pretty basically when I had the opportunity. I raised a lot of my own meat products. It was kind of, it was economical for me. My children in their 20s and 30s have always had an obsession with taking pictures of food from, like, back with the film cameras. They are very obsessed with food, but we've always been more of the back to the basics. You grow it, you slaughter it, you can it, you preserve it, and that sort of thing. So, like, this foodie thing has been a normal process of our life.
So you were there before it was cool, is what you're saying. You've been doing this with your family, and it's been something that you have made a part of your family culture, it sounds like, Jonna.
Exactly, exactly. And, like, with the posting of things and the posting of recipes, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of people are just miss those days where you're canning your tomatoes, as I am doing now. You call your lady friend saying, hey, what are you making for dinner tonight? I need some ideas, you know? Oh, you know, and you pull up a jar of this, or back then people went, oh, I, you know, my husband went out and shot some squirrels. We're having that tonight. I never did that, but.
All right, Jonna, thank you for that. And what about that, Eve? Is that something that you could credit an earlier generation with, maybe the back to the landers who really did want to be involved in their food from the beginning to the end?
Well, I think that there are definitely people in the older generation who have obviously always been invested in what they eat. And if you look back to the 1970s, there was a DDT scare, and that's when we had the macrobiotic movement and then the vegetarian movement. What's unique about today is just how many people are involved in the foodie movement. So it's not just people that are on the fringes. It's really the masses that are participating. And in terms of taking photos of your food, one of the more interesting things that I found is actually going back to the topic of sensory stimulation. So we are a generation that in many ways is sensory deprived. And through reading various studies, found that even looking at pictures of food or reading words that are associated with food, our gustatory and olfactory cortexes are stimulated. So that's still a way for us to experience some other form of sensory stimulation, even if we can't go slaughter our dinner or dig up our dinner.
Jonna, thanks a lot for that call. We're going to go next to Evelyn in Kenosha. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi.
What do you think?
Hi, this is Evelyn.
Sure. What is your comment about food?
I just wanted to say that a lot of people my generation, when we do something together, usually involves some form of food or an event or an activity that revolves around food, whether we're spending time with our family members or whether we're actually going out with our friends. Food is a huge part of our life, and it's a way, like even cooking at home is a way for us to connect with our loved ones, spend time together with them.
Great. Well, thank you for that comment. Is that pretty common, Eve? Is that what you're seeing, that for this generation? It's a gathering point that's a part of a lot of things.
Exactly. So the role of food really is as a community movement. So, you know, we're taking time to actually spend time face-to-face with people. We're not G-chatting them. We want to actually see them and talk to them in person. You're also seeing that show up in the restaurant scene with share plates and community tables. People really want to spend time with other people in person. So, you know, it's great to hear that it's happening and true in other situations.
All right. Thanks a lot, Evelyn. Next to Becca in Oak Mound. Hi, Becca.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring my voice to this conversation. I developed severe food allergies when I was in middle school. And as a millennial, they found that we've been developing a lot of different things. I'm allergic to BHT, BHA, MSG, different specific food colors, all of that. And I had to restrict my diet a lot when I was younger, and it's become easier and easier for me because of this foodie movement. I find that a lot of my friends are now taking those same things out and going with me to the grocery store and going with me to see what I'm buying. And I'm also a vegetable gardener, and I do my own canning and stuff. And what I've been finding is that the more that I share that with my friends, the more that they're saying, oh, you know, maybe this is affecting me in a community sense, or maybe it actually is making me feel better.
Interesting. Becca, thank you. Is that something that's passed around, that kind of sort of food wisdom and people learning from one another's experiences, whether it's eliminating something or adding something, Eve?
For sure. Sure, and I think that a lot of these trends are picking up because of friends trying something new, you know, whether that's restricting something, or maybe that's a new food, or maybe it's a new cooking technique. And I think that what you're touching on is super important, which is also that the food that we were raised with was highly processed. And people don't really know, you know, how exactly it's made. And today you're seeing a call for transparency, for simplicity, for processed foods that are, you know, a little bit more simple, that we can really understand what's in it, because, you know, we don't really understand still what the effects are of things, you know, that were common in the foods that we were raised with.
Now, I want to talk to you about something that you say in your book that could be a little controversial among some people. You say that we should just accept the fact that millennials are narcissistic. And if you want millennials to get beyond the photography of food and the obsession of food into the food policy stuff that advances to the greater good and goes out into humanity as a whole, that we need to accept that and appeal to that narcissism and use that narcissism. What do you think about that? Is that fair? Are millennials giving you any pushback about saying that, yes, millennials are narcissistic, but that's what we have to go with?
I mean, it's really funny. I haven't had anyone say to me yet, like, that's completely wrong, I disagree with you. And there's plenty of things that people can disagree with me on, but that's not one of them so far. You know, I went into this really thinking, are we so bad? If you read about millennials, you'll see a lot of people lamenting that we're lazy and, you know, we're self-obsessed. And I think the reality of the situation is that we grew up in this world where we need to be concerned about self-branding all the time. And we need to brand ourselves differently on Facebook than we do on LinkedIn, than we do on OkCupid. The way that we present ourselves is essential for getting a job or getting a date or sharing things with friends. And so we've become really great self-branders. And I think that that's a huge element of why the food movement has taken off in the way that it has, because again, we're using food as a new identifier, as a new form of social currency. I think that the idea that we can somehow make millennials less narcissistic and more altruistic is just not terribly realistic. So the question becomes, you know, how do you play into millennial wants and needs in order to achieve a greater good? And to me, that's by making things like organic a desirable brand to associate with. So the question becomes, what's the next thing that the food movement needs to achieve, and how can we make that a desirable part of the millennial brand?
As you said, you talked to some of the big luminaries in the world of food, like Michael Pollan. Did he have any ideas for making that transition?
You know, we had an interesting conversation around it. I don't know that he had any direct recommendations, but what I found was most interesting is he talked to me about the gay rights movement. And the fact that the gay rights movement is incredibly, it's multifaceted, and as is the food rights movement. So people are interested in it for a lot of different reasons. And what he said is that it was not a given that gay marriage would be the number one issue for the gay rights movement, that that needed to be decided upon, and that the community needed to gather around that one idea and fight for that first, and then move on to other things. And as we can see, they've been incredibly successful. So the question now becomes, what is the key agenda item for the food movement that people can coalesce around? And that's still to be determined. I would very much like to see it be food waste. And I do think that there are several signs that that is the next issue. It's tangible. It's something people can take pictures of. It's something that can end up on Pinterest. And that can have a really serious and significant impact on the agricultural economy, and food distribution systems and food accessibility. So I'm hoping that that's where things go, but we'll have to wait and see.
And you've actually started a project dealing with food waste, right?
Well, I developed a hashtag that I'm really hoping that people will participate in. So I made a goal for myself about a year ago to only throw out one plastic bag's worth of garbage. So one plastic bag, meaning like the type of bag that you would get from the 7-Eleven. So not your big garbage bag. Everything else that you consume should be either recyclable or compostable. And I am seeing some pickup in people saying, you know, I've been doing this forever, or people taking on the challenge. So it's hashtag waste less challenge. You can participate on Twitter. Post your pictures. If you are you're saving your food scraps and using it for food stock, or you've decided that you're going to buy a whole chicken and utilize the innards to cook up something great or create a pate. I really want this to become a movement of learning how to use whole animals, whole plants, and limiting the amount of waste that we're creating.
Eve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
That was Eve Turow, author of a new book called A Taste of Generation Yum, discussing the growing popularity of food and how our obsession is shaping how we eat.